Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Osterberg versus Peckham.
May it please the court, Mr. Larry Zinn will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The issues here concern the constitutionality and scope of the restrictions in the Texas election code on independent expenditures, which are core political speech under the First Amendment. I'd like to focus on these constitutional issues, but before I do so, I'd just like to say a word about the structure and issues of this appeal. There are basically four groups of issues that are before the court. They involve the constitutionality issues, they involve those of knowledge, those of express advocacy, and those of substantial compliance. Any of those issues alone, independently, we believe, are sufficient to strike down this judgment.
On your substantial compliance argument, your opponent says you didn't preserve that in the trial court. What's your answer to that? Did you raise it for the first time on appeal?
We, in our motion for judgment modified, in our post-judgment motions, we did challenge finding of the jury on sufficiency grounds. We did not mention substantial compliance, but we did bring a sufficiency challenge to the jury's answers to those issues. And we believe that that's sufficient.
So you raised a factual and legal sufficiency to compliance. In other words, no evidence or insufficient evidence to show failure to comply. Was that your point?
Our point was that the jury's answers to the issues that would speak to those issues was legally or factually insufficient. We did not mention the word substantial compliance.
So there was no question submitted to the jury in the context that you find that Mr. Burns substantially complied with the election law?
No.
So would you then concede that you didn't preserve that for appellate purposes so that we cannot have to deal with that?
Well, I will concede this, that the court's recent opinion in the Colster versus City of El Paso case is the same ground that the Court of Appeals ruled to hold that we waived the issue. I do not concede the point. I think that the evidence should be determined by the law and not by how it's submitted.
But there's a lot of law that says we look at the evidence based on the charge, not on what you thought the charge should be, but not you didn't object to it.
Yes, I agree that there is that law.
So it's a little stronger on the you didn't preserve it side than it is on your side of the argument.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes. The statute requires a knowing violation.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
What evidence would be required to show knowing violation of a statute?
Well, it could be a familiarity with the election code, perhaps a deep experience in political activities where you may have come in contact with these laws. We agree that when we're dealing with state of mind such as that, it could be proven circumstantially. Yet there must be some evidence that
a lot of candidates don't know the election code.
Well, in this case, there were several lawyers that wanted to help Judge Pecca after these ads came out. They formed a committee, Concerned Citizens for a Fair Judiciary, and they didn't know how to fill out the forms, and they had to ask Judge Pecca, and that's how they
did it. I thought ignorance of the law was no excuse.
Well, sometimes. But sometimes it is. And in certain areas, particularly those touched by the First Amendment, we do not want to punish people for their unsophisticated exercise of their free speech rights.
Well, but that argument goes to whether the state can pass a law that says you have to disclose and you have to do it in a certain manner. Is that right?
It goes partly to that, but the statute also says, and if you, the actual language of the statute is that it must be done knowingly, that you must knowingly make the expenditure in violation of Chapter 253. So the actual words themselves actually speak to knowingly actually speaks to the issue of in violation.
Are you sure it's that clear? It says that you must knowingly make the contribution, but it does not say that it must be knowingly in violation of the statute.
Well, the private cause of action statute, 253.131, I believe the specific language is that you must knowingly make the expenditure in violation of this chapter. And so the question is whether knowingly just modifies making the expenditure, or whether it modifies that whole phrase.
So under that scenario, why couldn't we have a political operative amass millions of dollars in funds with the intended purpose to influence elections in the state of Texas, and be able to forever avoid having to disclose the contributions being made as direct expenditures merely by avoiding ever learning anything about the election code?
Well, I would distinguish between bringing a private cause of action and punishing somebody, and a private cause of action is happening here, and simply, for example, the Attorney General bringing civil penalties against someone for failing to comply with the election code.
Well, would the knowing violation be different? The knowing violation for you is the same regardless of who's bringing the cause of action.
And my point is,
under your scenario, it's pretty senseless to even have a law on this whole topic, because if there is a law on this topic that requires knowledge of the law, then by golly, my main goal would be to never read the law.
Well, there must be deliberate ignorance is never unknowing, unwilling ignorance is.
Negligent ignorance.
Negligent? Negligence is not enough to punish people for knowing and willful violations.
But the argument would be, if this does impact First Amendment rights, there might be a reason the legislature tags on a knowingly element as opposed to other statutes with violations that don't require a knowing violation of the statute.
That's right, that the legislature did not want to punish the unwary who exercise their First Amendment rights, because these rights are so important that we don't want to punish people for just negligently or unintentionally violating the Texas election.
Maybe the legislature really wanted to put the bar at the point where the only people we want to punish with private action are those who intentionally violate the election code.
That's right. That the private cause of action, it's an onerous punishment when it comes, because it's liquidated damages and possibly including attorney's fees, is a very rare cause of action. It's rare in American jurisprudence. And so to focus a private cause of action and to only allow it under certain circumstances, they wrote it that way so that knowingly actually goes not only to the making of the expenditure, but to the knowledge of that it's in violation.
Okay, you're saying that that's the reason they wrote it that way, but you haven't provided us any information indicating that that is indeed why they did that. That's just your conclusion.
Yes. Okay. I have researched the bill history of all these cases. I have not listened to the tapes. I do not know the tapes were in existence at the time these laws were passed. And I'm not sure that I could be wrong, that a legislative history search would be very helpful, because particularly the private cause of action law goes back a long way. And I don't know that you're going to find much in terms of legislative history.
But in any event, the statute does require a knowing violation as one of the elements of the private cause of action.
Yes.
And the plaintiff would have the burden of proof on that element.
Yes.
And your argument is there's no evidence of
yes.
knowing. And if the court decided on that basis, they wouldn't reach the constitutionality of the statute.
That's true. That would be an independent ground to strike down the judgment.
Mr. Osterstack, help me understand your argument that this is a First Amendment case. Nobody's barring Mr. Osterstack from saying anything. She's not prohibited from saying anything. All the statute requires is that he report what he spent. But help me understand, if this is not so, help me understand that argument as how he's being, his speech is being curtailed in some way.
The Texas statutes are somewhat unique in that they don't make the forbidden conduct the failure to report. It says that if you fail to report, then you may not make the expenditure.
So you mean if you just wrote it the other way, it would be okay? Sounds kind of semantic.
Well, it's semantic, but when you think about it, the judgment reads, and the statute says, that my clients were assessed damages two times the amount of the illegal expenditures. These are independent expenditures. This is core First Amendment activity. It's constitutionally protected. The state legislature cannot make illegal what the Constitution protects. And yes, they could have wrote this, and in fact, most every other state in the union has done that, including the Federal Election Code itself. But Texas chose this other way, and they never changed these laws. These laws are pre-Buckley. They never changed these laws after Buckley, because Buckley made a very significant change in campaign finance law. It said that independent expenditures are not merely incidental conduct to First Amendment rights, that they are, in fact, core First Amendment activity, and the expenditures themselves are protected constitutionally.
How does Buckley help your claim that this case has an unconstitutional law?
Because in Chapter 253, in the general rule, 253.002, it says that a person may not knowingly make or authorize a direct campaign expenditure. Under the Texas Election Code, a direct campaign expenditure is our independent expenditures. And that is a crime. Is a Class A misdemeanor punishable by up to a year. Creates this general rule as to individuals, and it only creates two exceptions. One, if you're not acting in concert. And two, if you report it, assuming it's over $100, as you would a political action committee.
Right, so what's the violation?
The violation is that it ultimately makes the expenditure itself illegal, as opposed to the forbidden conduct of failing to report, or if you believe acting in concert is constitutional, that kind of activity.
If we interpret knowingly, if we define knowingly to include the, in essence, I know what the law is, but I'm going to violate it, that means I'm going to spend this money without reporting it. Doesn't that fit within the Buckley standard?
Not directly, but it speaks to the scope and importance of independent expenditures in our First Amendment jurisprudence, because they said in that case for the first time that these independent expenditures are for political speech. It is not merely incidental conduct that you can restrict as you would time, place, and manner other kinds of
things. So your theory is that it's not the requirement that it's reported that's the problem. It's because the statute says if you don't report it, but then you knowingly make it, it's now illegal.
Yes.
And therefore, that's what's protected, as opposed to what Buckley held, that the disclosure requirements are all constitutional, at least in that case, in that context.
That's correct. The Chapter 253 ultimately makes the expenditure itself illegal. And in fact, that's what that private cause of action says.
But it's illegal only if it's in violation of the statute. And the only violation here was the failure to report it before you made it.
Yes, but the state cannot take away your right to engage in that core political speech.
Well, they haven't.
Well, they have. They've made it illegal.
There are exceptions. In fact, Section B has a whole bunch of exceptions.
It does, but as to individuals, it has very narrow exceptions. Some of the exceptions swallow the rule.
Let's look at it this way. Let's assume Osterberg had reported. Would you agree there are no limitations on his ability to spend money to influence this election, provided he reported?
Well, no. Then they would have held that he was liable because he was acting in concert with his wife or others. There were two independent grounds for this judgment. One, that he failed to report, and two, that he was, quote, acting in concert with others.
But under your theory, under the judgment, this is to August, her first name, was not found liable because she didn't knowingly do anything as far as the jury was concerned.
Well, the jury found she was liable and a judgment was entered against her. It was the El Paso Court of Appeals that found that.
Well, and that's who we're looking at here, is what the El Paso Court did.
Yes.
Well, let's go back to fundamentals. Let's assume Mr. Osterberg was operating by himself. and that he reported. You agree that there is no infringement whatsoever on his ability to speak to the tune of $100, $38,000, or $100 million.
That's true. He would not have liability under Chapter 250.
Not liability. I'm not talking about liability. You agree he has total freedom to speak as long as he reports.
Yes, under independent expenditures, yes. But in the end, the state cannot punish. They've taken it one step though. Instead of punishing the failure to report, they've said because they are conditioning his right of free speech on the idea of reporting, and they cannot condition the spending of independent expenditures, that core political speech, for any reason, legitimate or not.
Just for the record, so you're not challenging the right or the statute requirement that you report. You're not saying that there's a constitutional impediment in that argument.
That's right. They can require independent expenditures to be reported, but they cannot say if you don't report it, we're taking away your right of core political speech. And that's what these statutes.
Well, they just tell you you're going to pay for it twice to the other side.
Yes. That's what the private cause of action requires.
And is that, are you challenging the constitutionality of that penalty? Essentially only Texas and California have set up this type of action.
Not so much the penalty, but the idea of a private cause of action limited only to an opposing candidate.
You're saying that's unconstitutional?
Yes, because it is not narrowly tailored to serve a compelling state interest, that there are other ways to do this without infringing on the rights in this way.
Any other questions?
I'm not sure I understand that last part. What if the statute had been drafted to say that you have the right to make these expenditures, but if you do, you have to report, and if you don't report, there's a private cause of action on behalf of the candidate that you oppose? Would you challenge that?
Yes, because it doesn't serve that state compelling interest in a narrow way, because it's really serving the personal interests of that candidate. It's using this idea of a private cause of action, but in fact, instead of serving the compelling state interest, which is to prevent corruption, it is allowing the candidate to use these state laws to serve a personal interest, which is to punish a political opponent. That's why they have the incentive to bring these actions.
But how can you punish your opponent if you report?
Well, had it been reported, putting aside the acting in concert language, and putting aside the other issues that the jury did not find, then that's right. They would not have been able to succeed on this private cause of action in finding that these expenditures were legal and against the code.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from response.
May it please the court, Mr. Mickey Milligan will present argument for response.
May it please the court.
You're not claiming that the provision that you cannot act in concert to spend over $100 is constitutional after Buckley, are you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, why?
Well, to me, that's what I tried to get into in the trial court was the aspect of political committee, whether you're going to have a committee or one person. And you can regulate, if you can regulate political committees, you can regulate two or more persons. I felt that this statute was poorly drafted from the standpoint it does not define how many people it takes for a committee. The statute talks about an individual, it talks about a political committee, but it doesn't say what that requires.
Well, if I decide that I'm going to put a TV ad on, speak my mind in some electoral race this year, I have to act in concert with somebody to do that, don't I? I mean, if I film it and tape it and edit it and give the voice over and run down to the television station and do all that myself, I still have to act in concert with the people who put it on the air, don't I?
Well, I think that would be a fact issue as to whether you're acting in concert with them or hiring people to do jobs. Whether I act in concert at my office with others, or I have people that I pay to do things. I find there's a distinction.
In any event, this is not necessary for the judgment. If there's a knowing, whatever the language is, the second part of the saving.
The knowing violation, and the question whether it means a knowing political contribution or political expenditure, or a knowing violation of the law. To me, an important part of this case is whether ignorance of the law is now going to be a defense. That's what the Court of Appeals has, in effect, ruled, because they say that we did not prove that the Osterbergs knew what they were doing.
Well, what? How could knowing ever be at issue if all the question was whether you were making a political expenditure? How could you ever unknowingly make a political expenditure?
I think you could give money to someone and not recognize that that's going to be a campaign contribution.
How? You didn't think it would be not a candidate?
Well, it might be the person, the candidate could write it down as a political contribution if you gave him money. I suppose someone could give someone money who they didn't know was a candidate, loaned him $1,000, and the candidate write it down in his form. They would not have known.
So what do you say is the proof in this case of knowing? What do you say is the proof that the Osterbergs knew about this expenditure?
Well, Mrs. Osterberg didn't show up at trial. She didn't ask. She wasn't sick, like the Court of Appeals said. There's no evidence at all as to why she didn't show up. She didn't ask for a continuance. But she signed all these checks. $28,600 and something worth of checks on this TV ad, and another $34,000 that the opposing candidate received.
But your argument was it's possible for somebody to make a contribution to pay the check without knowing that it's a violation. So what is your proof that this was a knowing violation? Knowing conduct in violation of the...
Our proof was the facts of the trial and the jury's finding, Your Honor.
Judge Pekka was talking to a bar association meeting, accusing Mr. Osterberg of violating the election code.
Well, there was also testimony that the Osterbergs have a restaurant, have a hobby, and that the group of people that they participate with were all meeting at the restaurant, and there was conversations about this race. That was in the evidence, too. That's where Mr. Beal was one of the group at the restaurant, and this went on day after day. And Mrs. Osterberg, the evidence showed, was also present at and during those discussions about this race. And both of them had previously had a case in Texas court, and that's how it's all.
So there's a... Can you tell me what? You say there were some meetings. What evidence is in the record that you say supports the jury finding that Mr. Osterberg made an expenditure with knowledge that it was a violation of the statute?
Well,
or maybe with knowledge they made an expenditure.
The only evidence we had was that the opposing candidate, Beal, testified that he heard Pekka say a month before the election at a bar luncheon that Osterberg was violating the campaign laws. And he testified he went back and told Osterberg.
And if all Osterberg needed to do was to make a filing, then there would have been no violation.
Had he filed on time,
is there any evidence in the record that Pekka's comment to Beal and Beal's comment to Osterberg was made at any point in time where the filings still were yet to be made or the period of time had already been passed? Or?
I believe it was dated. I think the bar luncheon meeting is dated approximately a month before and the election, and there was a filing, I believe, 8 days before the election.
And Beal's testimony is that he talked with Osterberg, gave Osterberg this information before that 8th day, or not?
I don't believe it's pinpointed as to when he did it. If that's your question, it's not pinpointed as to when he communicated Osterberg.
does the plaintiff still have the burden of at least showing, having some evidence, that Osterberg knew or had knowledge that his expenditure was in violation of the budget?
I don't believe so. I mean, my whole view of the statute is, if that is our requirement, there will be no recoveries under this act. We cannot prove someone's thoughts that they knew or did not know whether they were violating the law. And so have we met that burden of proving that Mr. Osterberg said, well, I know I ought to be reporting, but I haven't, I'm not going to. No, we haven't. And I have, from the very beginning, felt that if that's the requirement, this statute has no teeth. It's not going to work.
You do agree that there's a, at least as the Supreme Court has held in Buckley, there is a core element of speech here.
Yes, it's speech, Your Honor, but as was pointed out, there's no limit on what they can spend. They can spend anything.
But I mean, if it is free speech, and at the core of the First Amendment, then every part of a statute that regulates that has to be narrowly tailored to meet a compelling state interest, is it not?
Well,
I mean, we have to look at each one of these requirements that are necessary to sustain your judgment, right? With that same standard, we can't say, well, there's a high bar here, but there's a low bar over here, so it's all right.
I mean, Buckley also said that the reporting of independent expenditures was okay. And I mean, they said it, and that states have a right to do that.
Well, I was really leaning into the penalty part of this.
So,
and whether or not it's an appropriate regulation of core free speech to say if you slip up and don't follow one of these requirements, you can pay double the total amount you've expended to a private candidate plus attorney's fee. Question for you.
Well, I mean, that's the penalty. That's the penalty. Whether if you're asking me whether the acting in concert is a constitutional violation, I don't think so.
But we don't have to get to that. Under the cases that now comes to us, we don't have to pass on whether if I try to get a friend to go along with me, we're both in violation of the statute. We might have to do that in some cases. We don't have to in this one. We do have to pass on whether or not it's an appropriate regulation to try to discourage failure to report, to have the violator pay double the amount of the total expenditure to an individual.
Well, Ragsdale is the only other reported case on this matter, and clearly the court there, this court, affirmed their opinion on the damages and said whether the penalty is too high or too low is a legislative matter, and that, so this court affirmed.
Well, it's not. In Buckley, let me pick up on Chief's question. If you make this a capital offense, you probably violate the Constitution. But you can make it some kind of offense, not to report. That's what Buckley says. But you have to look and see what kind of offense is it. Maybe a misdemeanor is appropriate. That's kind of like what Buckley did. But is a cause of action for civil damages appropriate? Does it serve a state interest?
I feel it does because of the reasons of given in Ragsdale and in that Tennessee case, Bemis, that I cited. We don't have to have a state agency to do this. With the appropriate state expenditures that would take, there are thousands of elections in this state every election time. This statute says let the private parties do it, and to me that is a wonderful state interest to eliminate a huge bureaucracy that would be necessary to monitor.
So the state's interest is in promoting enforcement without encumbering the law enforcement.
Without making the taxpayer pay, and let the parties duke it out individually, and therefore he who violates pays.
Mr. Nugent, you argued that if the knowingly bar was sufficiently high, the statute would be meaningless. But if Judge Pekka had simply written a letter to Osterbergs, he apparently knew who they were, he apparently knew what they were doing, and demanded that they follow the election code, then the Osterbergs would have a difficult time defending the fact that they had knowledge that their expenditure was in violation of the election code. But so far, all you have is Judge Peck up in front of a bar association making a general statement of a violation of the election code and a statement from Beal that, well, I may have I mentioned it to Osterberg at some point later in time as your only evidence. It would not be hard to establish direct knowledge on the part of a violator if the candidate was serious about the allegation.
Having participated in this trial and the unique personalities involved, had Judge Pepper written a letter, I could see a response that it wasn't specific enough to point out the precise violation, or a response that we didn't understand it. And on and out, I think I mentioned in one of my briefs, does he have to give him a letter? Should he have given him a brief and cited the statutes and the cases? Should he then have to explain the brief? To me, once you get on the ignorance of the law is a defense, all of those questions come into play. I mean, how much is enough? Was it a letter? Did we have to cite each provision? Did we have to tell him why?
But if your point is that Judge Peck is saying this is a violation of the election code when the date for filing had not yet come, how can that be knowledge of a violation of the code?
Okay.
So the knowledge, it means violation doesn't occur until there's been a filing period, there's been no filing.
Well, that's one of the things that they had said was that you got to have knowledge at the moment of the expenditures, and of course, clearly on reporting, that's impossible. You spend the money, and then the reporting deadline doesn't fall for days or weeks later. So, to me, that's a reason for why knowingly applies to whether it was a political expenditure, not whether it violated the reporting statute, because it's impossible to violate reporting on the day you spend it.
But Buckley would say you can't regulate the expenditure. You can only regulate the reporting. So the knowledge has to be, seems to me, only in the failure to report, not the expenditure. The knowledge has to apply to the failure to report in order to be consistent with Buckley. Buckley would say you can't touch the speech issue out here, but you can require filing. So to make this statute constitutional, the knowingly would have to apply to the filing. It couldn't apply to the filing.
I think I look at Buckley different. I cannot accept that the U.S. Supreme Court, in effect, we have this situation then where we have ignorance of the law. And the only thing what struck me at the very beginning of this case is we are our children. Everyone knows that our society is built on the concept that ignorance of the law is not a defense. And once that is removed, I see no interest. And to me, that has to be, ignorance of the law has to be the fence for any ruling that says PECA cannot recover against the Osterbergs. It comes down to that. Did the Osterbergs know they were violating the statute? And how? What did they know? How much did they know? I mean, we get into infinitesimal arguments over whether we proved it. I see no end to it. And so I don't think that this case violates Buckley. Buckley said we're not limiting anything. We're simply saying you've got to follow the statute on reporting. And you can act in concert with another person, because if you do, you have become a committee, I think. It doesn't say two people. But that's why the statute, I think the statute is in good faith tried to regulate as best it can. It says individuals, political committees. Well, what's a political committee? In Bemis, that Tennessee case, they said two or more. I think Texas should be, but that hadn't been addressed by the courts. And so I see no way to, if knowing is going to be part of it, I don't think it'll work.
Knowing's in the statute.
That's true. I mean, knowing as to that you know you're violating the law. I mean, you can't know when you actually pay the money. I mean, certainly we're confronted with current events on the federal scene, campaign finances is a big issue. Red Chinese government and all sorts of people, apparently, from what we hear, are making contributions, expenditures, whatever they are. This statute would get to the bottom of that. This statute says you've got to report it. But you don't have to report it if you don't know that the statute requires that. That means, as this court has previously said, somebody is not going to be reporting because they didn't know. I don't see how it can work. I see we're going to have chaos if that is to be announced.
Is the private cause of action the only remedy for a failure to report by the officers?
The Attorney General can bring the criminal charges in this statute.
So the only issue is whether or not a private cause of action, if you're going to have a private cause of action, what does it mean?
Well, to me, the way I look at it, it's better than having a huge state bureaucracy to monitor the elections in every city and every county of the state. I don't know what that would take. It would take a lot of people. So to me, this is capitalism at its best. If someone involved or a candidate believes there has been a violation, he files his lawsuit. After all, the statute says if he doesn't win, the defendant can sue him for his fees and expenses. So to me, it's the best way. And that's what Ragsdale, in their discussion, we're talking about, that it does serve a compelling state interest because we don't have to have a state organization to look over it and to check every, I mean, I can't imagine how many elections I didn't go look it up there are in the state, on city, county, state level. There must be thousands. As to one of the points we had asked is for our attorney's fees. We had an unusual trial. It was on a Saturday when we got the verdict. The jury did not come back with fees. They came back with the twice the amount. We all had gotten there at 8 o'clock. Finally, at 10:30, the jury said, we cannot go on. The attorney's fees were at the end of the charge. And no, I didn't send them back in and say, no, Judge, we've got to send them back in, because each one of them said, that's it. We can't do any more. It's 10:30. Everyone was exhausted. I filed a motion for entry of judgment asking for my fees because they had not been controverted by anyone. And that amount in my briefs, I believe it's about 28,000 fees. And I believe, and I understand the regular law is the Fleet case, that there are times when you've got to either not accept the verdict or send the jury back. Here they said they couldn't go on, because there were those political political committee questions in the charge, and they got hung up on that. And so I filed my motion for fees. And my basis is, under Ragsdale, since the court said that when the fees are reasonable and uncontroverted as a matter of law, the trial court can be assessed. And so that's where I'm coming from there. And I believe it's unique to this particular case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. The only compelling state interest that the U.S. Supreme Court recognizes in the restriction of independent expenditures is the prevention of corruption or the appearance of corruption. They have recognized none other. In analyzing these statutes, including whether knowledge involves violation of statute or just applies to making expenditures, you must keep that in mind, because if the statute doesn't serve that purpose and is narrowly tailored to serve that purpose, then that statute violates the First Amendment.
Well, what is not true?
Excuse me?
Buckley says there's two other purposes. Informing the electorate on where money comes from, and getting data necessary to prosecute violations.
If Your Honor,
page 66 to 67.
If Your Honor, please, as to independent expenditures, the only recognized compelling state interest. And they said this in the NC PAC case, in Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinion in 1985, citing Buckley. And I feel pretty confident about that. I could be wrong. But as to independent expenditures, there's different as to campaign contributions, but as to independent expenditures, the only compelling state interest is the prevention of corruption or the appearance of corruption. And that is why they struck down any limitations on expenditures, because they said independent expenditures do not involve corruption in the sense that the possibility that campaign contributions should.
Can you compel the identity of the leaders who made him incorrect? Can the state compel disclosure of who is making the expenditures?
Only if it's express advocacy. If it is not express advocacy, it cannot. And there's also going to be a limitation on, in the McIntyre case, on anonymous pamphleteer and things like that. They have to be very careful with when they require people to speak their speech when it's done anonymously. Because in the McIntyre case, they held that the state could not do that.
Did this TV ad have any disclaimer about who paid for it?
Yes, it did. It said, ad paid for by Bob Osterberg, at the end of it. And anyone who saw the ad saw the disclaimer. There was no secret pack with a nice sounding thing or anything. It was just Bob Osterberg. I paid for the ad.
So he knew he had to do the disclaimer on the actual ad that he spent the money for.
If you saw the ad, you saw it paid for by Bob Osterberg.
That's what I mean. He knew that's required by the election law.
No, he didn't know that. He was helped by a friend who worked with the TV station. And the TV station worked with a friend, and I guess they required that. It didn't say political ad paid for by Bob Osberg. It said paid for by Bob Osberg. I believe that was...
Well, but you've already told us that in your mind it's clearly political speech, the ad.
Absolutely, but it wasn't express advocacy. There's a difference.
It was?
It was not express advocacy.
What's wrong? Why did vote against him express advocacy, however muddled the message?
Well, because earlier in the message it says vote for him.
Yeah, you want a pointy-headed intellectual.
Well, it says if you want a judge who's intelligent, hardworking, and well-respected by his peers, which usually is enough, vote for him. But it says if you want to return the courthouse to the people, vote against him.
And vote for the plaintiff in this case.
Well, no, it didn't mention the name of the opponent. It only mentioned the name of Judge Peckett when it said vote for Judge Peckett. And then later on the ad it said, if you want somebody who's going to bring the courthouse back to the people, vote for his opponent. It contained two messages to the people. And the Supreme Court has created a bright line test for express advocacy. That it's not, if it's ambiguous in any way, it's sort of like a contract. If it's ambiguous, it's not express advocacy. If it contains conflicting messages, it is not express advocacy. And the First Amendment requires that.
Can I get you to refocus on the knowing issue once again? And can I get you to reference section 253.002?
Yes.
And 253.131?
Yes.
253.002 is the initial provision that says that direct campaign expenditures are unlawful.
Yes.
And it says this, a person may not knowingly make or authorize a direct campaign expenditure,
yes.
Period. So in other words, it talks about it is a violation if a campaign expenditure is made knowingly. It doesn't say anything about knowingly in violation of this act.
Yes.
Okay. Then if you go to 253.131, this concerns the civil enforcement provision, where it says a person who knowingly makes or accepts a campaign contribution or makes a campaign expenditure. So that part reads the same way that 252.002 does. Then it adds, in violation of this chapter, is liable for damages as provided in this section. Now, is this a... let's say some passive writing by the legislature. If the legislature had said something that says exactly the same, a person who knowingly makes or accepts a campaign contribution or makes a campaign expenditure that violates this chapter is liable for damages. In other words, it just says that if that knowing contribution that's referenced in 253.002 violates what is provided in this chapter, then you're going to be liable for these civil damages. Why does all that taken together not mean that the knowing that's referenced in the civil enforcement provision is the same as the knowing in 253.002? And that is knowing that the contribution was made, as opposed to knowing that it was done in violation of the chapter.
Because the language in violation of this chapter, first of all, only occurs in 253.131. That distinguishes it from 0.002. Second, where it's placed in the statute is right after making the expenditure. Knowingly makes the expenditure in violation of this chapter. So knowingly could either modify, just make the expenditure, which doesn't make much sense because making the expenditure is core political speech. The legislature certainly is not trying to tie the mens rea to something that's constitutionally protected. They want to tie the mens rea to the forbidden conduct.
Okay, but
that's
they,
what they're punishing in that statute.
But
and
they
the
did
forbidden
tie the
conduct
mens,
is in violation of the chapter.
But they did tie the mens rea to merely making the contribution in 253.002.
Yes, the language in point 002, the language of in violation of the chapter is not in that particular statute. But we were found liable. It's sort of a, they're all referenced together. But ultimately, we were found liable under 253.131, the private cause of action. That was the basis for the damages against us. And then it referenced back to the violation in point 002, but it is 253.131 that Judge Pecca must prove to get his damages. And that statute says, in violation of this chapter, in a particular way, they could have written it differently so that it was clear that you knowingly only applied to making the expenditure. But I'd say that if they did that, that would probably be unconstitutional. But they could have written it differently so it only said that, but they didn't.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. That concludes the argument in the second clause, and the court will now take another recess.